Thank you for downloading this podcast. This is a special episode recorded to accompany a new Pardes video on the same passage of Talmud. You can find it on our website at www.pardes.org.il/livingtext. This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Let us take a closer look at the Talmudic passage that served as the inspiration for the short video produced by Pardes, Text Comes Alive at Pardes. Talmudic texts are often multi-layered in their structure. They are many times products of later generations discussing earlier traditions and sources, adding layer upon layer of discussion, until finally resulting in the composition formulated in the final stages of the editing of the Talmud. Without conducting a comprehensive textual analysis of the text we are discussing, even a quick skim of the passage reveals an interesting fact. The narrative is in the Aramaic of the Talmud Bavli. Only biblical citations and an occasional quotation assigned to one of the characters in the story is in Hebrew. This is obviously lost in the English translation, but is very apparent in the original text. This has one exception. Lines 1 and 3 of the text, in bold letters in the source sheet, are the only lines of narrative that are in Hebrew. This would seem to suggest that this section might be the early core narrative around which the entire presentation developed. Possibly these two lines represent a report of an event which later was discussed, clarified, and embellished to produce the full-blown narrative included in the Talmud. Let us first consider this core narrative on its own. On one occasion, Rebbe issued a decree that they should not teach disciples in the open public marketplace. Rebbe Chia went out and taught the sons of his two brothers in the open marketplace, Rav and Rabba, son of Bar Chana. Let us first say a few words about the rabbinic personalities involved in this event. Rebbe, a common reference to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, is one of the central and dominant characters in the pantheon of classic rabbinic figures. He is the Nasi, the patriarch. He holds an official position of leadership within the Jewish community and the rabbinic establishment. He is highly respected and revered for his wisdom and stature and is undisputedly the voice of authority in his generation. He is, of course, the redactor and producer of the Mishnah, a canonical text of oral law, influential and central to our tradition to this very day. In this core narrative, Rebbe strongly opposes the teaching of Torah in the Shuk, in the public marketplace. He issues an official decree against this practice. Rabbi Chia defies this decree. He takes his two nephews and somewhat defiantly teaches them Torah in the Shuk. Rabbi Chia, too, is a well-known rabbinic figure of this time. As we know from other sources of the Talmud, he originates from Bavel. He comes to Eretz Yisrael to pursue his study of Torah and rises to a central position in the rabbinic world in Eretz Yisrael. He is described in many sources as a close associate of Rebbe, oftentimes debating, discussing, disputing, and generally assisting Rebbe in his leadership roles. It is he, no other, who defies Rebbe's prohibition in this passage. I would like to also draw your attention to one other element in this concise narrative. Rabbi Chia is described as teaching his nephews in the Shuk. He does not defy the decree by teaching random people in the Shuk, nor does he gather members of the community at large to teach in public. He brings his own students, members of his own family, who are students of Torah already, and teaches them in the market. The narrative identifies these students as Rav and Rabba Bar Bar Chana, both very well-known rabbinic figures themselves who will play a significant role in the next generation of Torah scholars. Rav especially will be associated with the establishment of the Academy of Sura in Bavel, which together with the Academy of Pumpedita will essentially produce the Talmud Bavli generations later. This point is potentially of interest, and I will come back to this later. The core narrative does not offer an explanation for the prohibition issued by Rebbe, nor does it explain the reason behind Rabbi Chiya's defiance of this prohibition. The reader reading this report is left to conjecture and speculate about both their motives. As one thinks of possible motives for prohibiting the teaching of Torah in the Shuk, a number of things come to mind. First, Rebbe is a teacher. He's a master teacher. He knows that study requires focus, concentration, and quiet. The Shuk is full of noise, activity, sights, and smells. It is a place too full of distractions to facilitate effective learning. Perhaps it is from this perspective that he issues the prohibition. Perhaps he's concerned about exposure. Studying Torah in the public marketplace exposes the conversations and debates of the rabbis to all ears and eyes. Possibly there are elements of the process involved in the study and development of Torah that are better left unexposed to the layperson's attention. Passersby, untrained in Talmudic methodology, might overhear snatches of conversation that will be misconstrued and will impact negatively on the stature and authority of the Torah and of the rabbis themselves. Perhaps he's concerned about the possible influences that the Torah itself might be exposed to when brought into the market. The market reflects trends and contemporary ideas that might diminish the eternal truths of the Torah. Subjecting Torah and its study to the current trends of public marketplace could be damaging and distorting. Better to keep it isolated, insulated, and protected, so as to preserve its integrity and sanctity. I am, however, also struck by the particular wording of the decree as presented here. The prohibition is not just against teaching Torah outside the Bet Midrash, in the public sphere. The prohibition is specifically against the marketplace. This leads me to wonder about the particular nature of the market and Rebbe's concern about its effect on Torah. The market is a commercial space. It is a place of buying and selling, business and profit. Perhaps Rebbe is concerned about the effect of turning Torah into a commercial commodity. What happens when Torah is a product subject to market forces? What happens to wisdom when it has to compete in the marketplace? What happens to education when it begins to think in terms of profit and loss? Specifically in our times, this is a concern that I find myself strongly sharing, and I sense a level of identification with Rebbe's desire to keep spiritual and intellectual activity outside the context of intensive marketing and commercializing. Let's go back to the text as it appears before us in the Talmud. This core narrative is developed into a much more detailed presentation. The Talmudic narrator inserts, immediately following the description of Rebbe's decree, his suggestion as to the motivation lying behind the prohibition. What was his exposition? Line 2 in the source. What was his exposition? The roundings of thy thighs are like the links of a chain. Song of Songs, chapter 7. Just as the thigh is concealed, so the words of the Torah are also to be concealed. The Talmudic narrator links Rebbe's decree with a verse in Song of Songs, creating a conceptual context for this prohibition. Song of Songs uses the imagery of love, intimacy, and yearning. By citing this verse in this context, the commentator seems to be suggesting that this is the context from which Rebbe views the activity of engaging with the Torah. Studying the Torah is an act of intimacy, bonding, drawing on the model of erotic love as its inspiration. By comparing the Torah with the thigh, an intimate area of the body kept covered and private, he intensifies our feelings about bringing the Torah out in the open and engaging with it in the context of the Shuk. Just as we all deeply and intuitively feel that physical intimacy and bonding between lovers is inappropriate to the Shuk, and requires seclusion and private space. So, the commentator suggests, Rebbe wishes to create that sense as strongly and as in deeply regarding the study of Torah. He accesses our innate sense of intimacy to create that same feeling about our engagement with Torah. By inserting this commentary to Rebbe's decree, the Talmudic narrative both creates a specific context for understanding Rebbe's objection to studying in the Shuk, as well as possibly also intensifying our sense of identification with his position. On that note, let us also note that no parallel comment appears on behalf of Rabbi Chiya. The narrator of the Talmud does not follow the description of Rabbi Chiya's defiance with a clarification of his thoughts and motives. Rather, he continues to describe Rebbe's response upon hearing of this act of defiance and presents a description of the confrontation that takes place when the two protagonists next meet each other face to face. Line 4. Rebbe heard of this and was angry. And when Rabbi Chiya next presented himself before him, Rebbe said to him, "Iya, who is calling you outside?" He realized that Rebbe had taken the matter to heart and submitted himself to the disability of a reproof for 30 days. Rabbi Chiya comes before Rebbe, as is his practice. He, we should note, does not perceive his act of defiance to be an all-out rebellion against Rebbe. It appears that he still considers himself a member of Rebbe's circle and a follower of his teachings. He has not cut off his ties from Rebbe. Rebbe, however, is angry and responds to his presence by asking rhetorically, "Who is calling you outside?" Clearly referring to his disobedient choice to teach Torah outside. Perhaps he is saying to him, "You so desire to teach outside that you disobey my instructions? Well then, go outside. That is where you choose to be. One cannot belong both to the inner circles of Torah study and also be so drawn to the outside." Particularly striking is the way Rebbe addresses Rabbi Chiya here. He calls him Iya, with an ayin, which is not his name. There is one other place in the Talmud where someone calls Rabbi Chiya Iya, and it apparently is not complimentary. It appears to be a mocking pronunciation of his name, perhaps suggesting the braying of a donkey. Insulting, to say the least. However, there's an additional possibility supported by information available from additional sources in the Talmud. It is possible that this mispronunciation of Rabbi Chiya's name is a mockery, not of his name, but of his manner of speech. Apparently, Rabbi Chiya had difficulty pronouncing gutturals, and his chet sounded very much like an ayin. This could be a result of his foreign origins. He is a relatively recent arrival from Bavel and has an accent that is mocked here by Rebbe. Possibly also a not-so-gentle reminder that Rabbi Chiya is indeed an outsider who chooses the outside over the inner chambers of the Beit Midrash and defies the authority of the Nasi who presides over the insider world of the rabbinic community. Things are apparently becoming personal and a bit nasty in this confrontation. Rabbi Chiya gets the point. He understands the extent of Rebbe's anger and takes upon himself to depart the Beit Midrash temporarily. He banishes himself from the Beit Midrash for a 30-day period. The narrative continues, lines 6 through 8. On the 30th day, Rebbe sent him a message saying, "Come," and then later he sent him a message not to come. What was he thinking when he sent him the first message, and what was he thinking when he sent him the second? At first he thought, part of the day may be deemed equivalent to the whole day. And in the end he thought, we do not say part of the day may be deemed equivalent to the whole day. In the end, he came. Said Rebbe to him, "Why have you come?" Rabbi Chiya replied, "Because you, sir, sent for me to come." "But then I sent to you not to come." He replied, "The first messenger I saw, the other I did not see." Thereupon Rebbe cited as appropriate the text, "When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him." After a confusion of messages sent from Rebbe to Rabbi Chiya to rejoin the community of the Beit Midrash, suggesting perhaps some inner conflict on the part of Rebbe, who strongly desires the return of his colleague, yet feels unable to accept him back quite yet. The Talmud adds a clarification that the confusion is due to a halachic principle, whether the final day of the 30 days counts as already completing the 30 days or not, But the sense that it also might reflect an inner conflict is still there. When Rabbi Chiya eventually does appear before Rebbe, explaining that the summons to appear had been delivered, but the cancellation had not reached him, at which point Rebbe cites a verse. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. A verse from Proverbs. We are left wondering, who is the man whose ways please the Lord, and who is the enemy who is manipulated into making peace with him? Does Rebbe mean himself? And the delay of the messenger canceling the summons is God's way of causing his enemy, Rabbi Chiya, to make peace with him? Is this a confirmation on the part of the narrator, placing this verse in the speech of Rebbe that Rebbe is in the right? Or is it possible that the verse refers to Rabbi Chiya? He is the man whose ways please the Lord, and it is God's manipulation that forces Rebbe to make peace with him. The ambiguity of interpretation highlights the nature of the dispute between the two. Which of them represents the way that pleases the Lord? The narrative leaves us unsure. And finally, the narrator turns to offer a clarification of Rabbi Chiya's motives in breaking the decree of Rebbe. Lines 9 and 10. Wherefore, sir, asked Rebbe, did you act thus, contrary to my decree? Because, replied Rabbi Chiya, it is written, wisdom cries aloud in the streets. Said Rebbe to him, if you read scripture once, you have not read it twice. If you've read it twice, you've not read it three times. And if you've read it three times, they who taught you have not explained it to you. Rabbi Chiya turns to Mishlei, to Proverbs, not to Song of Songs. Torah is not an intimate act of lovemaking. It is wisdom. And wisdom needs to be present in the market, sounding its voice in the streets. Rebbe is not impressed. He suggests to Rabbi Chiya that he lacks full appreciation of this verse and its proper meaning. He's not been around long enough or had enough access to the bearers of tradition to fully understand this verse. Rebbe, the representative of the innermost circles of rabbinic tradition, claims to have understanding that Rabbi Chiya clearly does not have. Rebbe himself does not offer the alternative understanding of this verse. It is the narrator of the Talmud who suggests what this alternative understanding might be by citing an interpretation formulated by Rava four generations later than the time of Rebbe and Rabbi Chiya. In line 11. The text, wisdom cries aloud outside, is to be understood as Rava explained it. For Rava said, if one studies the Torah inside, the Torah proclaims its merit outside. Torah, perhaps like all great spiritual and intellectual ideas, is nurtured and developed within the quiet and isolation of the study hall. It then proclaims itself in the streets, impacting and affecting the wider, broader community. It's not developed and studied in the shuk, although it will eventually impact and enhance the life in the shuk as well. However, the narrator gives Rabbi Chiya the last word. Exploring the possible ways Rabbi Chiya might have understood the text cited by Rebbe earlier as the inspiration for his position against studying in the shuk, in line 11. And how does Rabbi Chiya explain the verse, the roundings of thy thighs? He explained it in reference to the dispensing of charity and acts of loving kindness. It seems that the narrator leaves us with the debate still ongoing. Neither appears to have convinced the other, nor does the narrator of the story seem to be strongly endorsing one side or the other. Rebbe's position is given a strong and fair representation, although at certain moments it seems that the narrator might be drawing our attention to some less than admirable qualities in the way Rebbe responds to the dissenting opinion of Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya's position, too, is represented with sympathy and recognition. And as is often in the case in Talmudic discussion, we are left without a simple or absolute resolution to the debate, perhaps because there is indeed truth on both sides. However, I would like to conclude with an additional remark. I have already pointed out that the narrator of the story recognizes that neither side has the absolute and complete truth. Nevertheless, familiarity with the world of the Talmud, to which the narrator and quite likely his intended audience belong, highlights yet another aspect of this story. We have already noted the fact that Rebbe is associated with the canonical text of the Mishnah, representing the authorized central text of the rabbinic world. Rabbi Chiya too is identified with an important and significant project of oral law. He is the master of the Braitot, the external traditions not included by Rebbe in the Mishnah. According to some traditions, he is the compiler of the Tosefta, an appendix to the Mishnah that preserves additional traditions left out by Rebbe. I'm struck by the parallels between the dispute in the story and the individual projects associated with each of these personalities within rabbinic tradition. Rebbe is the voice of the authorized rabbinic establishment. He decides what's in and what's out. His text is canonized and becomes the voice of authority within the Bet Midrash. Rabbi Chiya collects the outsiders, the Braitot, the traditions left out of the canon, and recognizing their importance, insists on preserving them alongside the authoritative Mishnah. The Talmud, it should be noted, often accesses these external traditions as it studies and discusses the Mishnah, modeling, as the story itself did, its appreciation for the truth of both perspectives. It is noteworthy that Rav and Rabbah Bar Bar Chana, the nephews of Rabbi Chiya, will continue in Rabbi Chiya's path in the next generation, representing Talmudic mainstream inclination to include more than just the internal traditions of the Mishnah. Tradition requires insiders. It requires an establishment, a voice of authority, one that directs and creates core canonized traditions and texts. But it needs just as strongly the perspective of the outsider, who insists on accessing and preserving additional voices and ideas, enriching the tradition and keeping it vital and strong. The rabbis teach us that disputes that are for the sake of heaven will last forever. This dispute, apparently, is of that sort. As the Jewish world today continues the debate regarding the world of Torah and Jewish life, isolation or participation, insular communities or open, inclusive ones, formal established institutions or empowered lay people, inward-focused or outward-focused, let us note that we apparently continue an essentially Jewish debate that has deep roots in our Jewish tradition.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.